développés, les projets vont de l'avant, mais il y a toujours des formes de résistance qui reviennent, évidemment, qui continuent. Puis c'est ça qui est une grande centrale, et ça va continuer à grandir, et une grande partie de la société civile se range derrière ces mouvements autochtones qui portent une conscience et une vision de la Terre puis de l'être humain, et puis c'est là qu'on est à un tournant.
Still looking for a holiday gift or two for the special people in you.
19. We must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip. And self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to the December 21st edition of Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Jajage. I'm your host, Kai Ryla, and today we're playing a podcast that queer Indigenous artist Demian Dinet-Diage did with the Talking to Ghosts podcast. The episode explores their recent performance at PICA's Time-Based Arts Festival, having to adjust to performing during the pandemic and forest fires over the summer, and creating the RISE Fund to help empower queer, trans, two-spirit, and gender gradient Indigenous artists and individuals. The podcast is around 95 minutes, so we're just going to play the first 55 minutes. You can listen to the rest of the episode online wherever you find your podcasts, that's Talking to Ghosts. As a content note, there's some coarse language in this episode. Enjoy.
Welcome to Talking to Ghosts. I'm Wes Mueller.
And I'm Michael Kurt.
And we're having conversations with creatives. Who are we having a conversation with today, Michael Kurt?
Demian Dinet-Diage.
Yeah. Demian, if you're not familiar with them, is an artist, a poet, and a lot more, which you'll hear about in the interview. We had a great time talking with them. And without any further ado, here's the interview. again, thank you so much for being on. We super appreciate it. I wanted to ask, I think we both became familiar with your work through TVA this year and the Shatter performance. And I was curious what it felt like performing at TVA this year compared to all the previous years that you've worked with TVA.
I mean, I think it was challenging because, I mean, we weren't even sure if TVA was going to happen at that point. I mean, I think most people were just a little bit, we just had, none of us were completely certain what public performance was going to look like. Just being in, like, thrust into the middle of a pandemic. And I think most of the programming for TVA sort of happens like around the time that the pandemic was happening. So even PICA wasn't sure what was going to happen or what it was going to look like. But as the conversations progressed, you know, one thing that became pretty evident was the fact that they were interested in still supporting artists and still maintaining the integrity of what TVA is. And so PICA also, you know, through their gala that they have in the spring, you know, a lot of that was also done through Zoom and through the you know, the interface of the web. And so I figured that, you know, there would be some sort of like performance of it that would just transpire through digital media. And so that's what I was kind of looking forward to, or at least looking at the time. Kevin and I were kind of like trying to figure out what that would look like. Especially because one aspect of that performance in particular for Shatter is about not documenting the performance itself. And so when we go into the performance, and we didn't do this on the first night of the performance, just because we were in the middle of the wildfire, there was a lot of shit going on. But on the second night, in the first two iterations of the performance, the first one being at Disjecta for the Portland Biennial last year, and then the second one being at Knowledge of Wounds at Performance Space in New York in January of this year, you know, we start off the performance by saying, you know, we do not want documentation of this. You know, your form of documentation is to talk about it, is to write about it, and to share it with your community. We didn't want any sort of like video, audio, or photographic sort of public archiving of it. We were really interested. I've been really interested actually in challenging the viewer, the audience member, to actually write about the piece and talk about it and continue this sort of like oral history that I feel like just gets lost. And so Shatter was a one additional area of my practice where I was able to sort of engage that. And so, you know, working with TBA and working with PICA this year, it really tested that. It changed that. And because of the pandemic and the situation that we were sort of like thrust into, we realized that at least for the ways that PICA was engaging with the audience and using their online platform, we saw the benefits of at least showing that performance for the duration of the festival itself. So people were able to come back to it. People were able to witness it. And, you know, Kevin and I were also able to like view it and see it. Cause on our side, like, you know, apart from the performance or, you know, but the performance space, performance of it, you know, we had audio of it, but we didn't have any sort of like visual record of it. So, we were also able to witness like what we had done and what that looked like. And so it was interesting. It was intense. It shed a light onto that performance that we just would not have otherwise been able to see if the circumstances of this year hadn't, you know, presented themselves in that way.
Yeah, one of the things you talked about in the artist talk after that performance was how one of the aspects of the performance was to break a number of objects that you'd collected for the performance. But during the first performance in the forest fires, it didn't feel as important at the moment because there was so much else going on in the world. Because the performance that we saw was the first one, and it was maybe the day before or the day after the forest fires started, and we're like really impacting a lot of people very quickly. And I was wondering, in subsequent performances after that as part of TBA, did it feel the same, or were you able to kind of more clearly go in and finish your original intention?
Yeah, that first performance was difficult. Right before we got on, we were watching, you know, footage of like the devastation of small communities in Oregon, you know, people who probably didn't have a lot to begin with, you know, within like capitalist terms. You know, their entire homes were destroyed, and that was really devastating to watch, you know. And so going into it, I reached a point in like the climax of the performance where I was like, I don't even want to like destroy shit. Like, I don't want to break anything. But then, you know, I just had to remind myself of how fire itself has been used as a colonial tool against indigenous peoples. Not just a physical act of like, you know, burning livestock or crops or entire swaths of land and or villages and homesteads and teepees and hogans and, you know, that physical act, but also the way that fire is manifested through war and genocide. And today we have bombs and machine guns and rifles and so there's just all these other factors that really just like flooded in at that moment during the performance. And it just kicked in, and, you know, we were able to go through with the performance, but it felt different. It was a really strange moment. And so the second night of the performance, we had come back to it maybe like a week and a half later. I forget the exact date that it was or the length of time, but yeah, we were able to resurrect, I guess, the original intention of the performance. It felt even more potent at that point because we had gone through the forest fire. That energy was still there. The air was clear. People were still sort of like devastated by it. And of course, like racial injustices were still like presenting themselves as they are to this day, regardless of like the election results. But I feel like as Indigenous people, like these issues will always be pertinent until the settler colonial nation state like plunders, falls, is destroyed. You know, we have been dealing with these issues for centuries, and very little has changed. So yeah, I feel like that second performance was maybe in some ways even better than the first one. And we also really reflected on it afterward, like on that second performance before we like came together before the performance to kind of just talk about it and get psyched up about it. Kevin and I talked about like how intense it was to actually do that first performance. Like, we felt it was important. It was September 11th. You know, the entire year has just been a shit show. The entire 4 years, you know, or years leading like since I've been born have just been a shit show. But like, I feel like it was just really important for us to do that performance on September 11th, to do that first performance in the middle of a wildfire, to talk about these issues and how even forest fire and climate change like go hand in hand with like colonialism and continued forms of genocide against the environment and against Indigenous, Black, Brown, and Asian Pacific Islander and communities. So, but it was hard. It was really difficult at the time to realize that maybe we were putting ourselves into like a very unhealthy situation just with our own personal health. So So I don't know. I'm just, we were just completely like thankful and are 100% like over the moon in love with like Pika and Pika staff, who were like willing to go through that with us and who were willing to be there and give it like their all in order for us to do this performance. Like that was astounding. That was amazing. I think it's also important to note that, you know, that type of showing up in solidarity is also what like Indigenous Black and Brown communities need. So I also thank them for holding that space for us.
You mentioned you had performed Shatter twice before TBA, and before, it sounded like that was before the quarantine and everything started. Said earlier in January and late last year. How do you feel like the difference in the circumstances between those performances and having to perform it in front of like a limited audience over the internet made the performance itself feel to you as a performer?
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I feel, well, okay, so that was weird. Like performing in front of a camera and all that was really weird. I think if we had more time, it would have been really nice to have like a behind the music, like sort of, what was that like VH1 special where they would have like little pop-up video, right?
Yeah.
They would have like,
oh yeah, yeah. Come up.
I think it would have been really awesome to like engage in that way. If we had just thought about it a little bit beforehand instead of just joking about it at the time. But it was that, especially for that first performance, it was so fucking difficult to not see how the camera was like just in front of us. You know, we put these like two plinths on the floor, and I think that was also a mistake because it really felt like I had to like engage with them or be on top of them. It really just distracted me. So there were all these sort of just like elements of performing in front of a camera that just felt even like extra performative. But the second night, like, you know, I think I was just like, fuck it. Like, I'm just going to ignore them. I'm just going to ignore the fact that anyone in the audience is here. I think a smaller, more intimate sort of setting is probably more ideal for the piece. I don't know how it would change if it was like a larger audience. And I also think that it's important to also note that when we performed it in performance space, like that space was a very intentional festival. Like Knowledge of Wounds was about bringing together Indigenous and primarily like queer and two-spirit and trans, gender non-conforming and communities to showcase our work. And so that performance was special. That, you know, the curation that SJ Norman and Joseph Pierce did was amazing. It allowed us to be in direct community with like queer, two-spirit kin, but more importantly, Indigenous kin. And so we were able to have conversations with one another leading up to the performance and afterward about how performance and Indigenous forms of performance are a ceremonial catharsis. And so, you know, we really think of that piece, Shatter, as a form of catharsis, like the act of destruction as a form of catharsis, not from like a settler colonial perspective, but from an Indigenous perspective that is more centered around reclamation and subversion of, you know, the atrocities of settler colonialism. I feel like each time in each place that performance is engaged, it is continually changing, as does like most visual work, or even written work. You know, whenever you read something, like it changes from person to person. It has like a site specificity that is that reaches like so far out. You know, it was interesting to perform that piece within like different types of socio-political sort of timeline. You know, the last performance of that piece was almost a year ago to the initial day that we had performed it at the Portland Biennial at Disjecta. And so much had changed within that like year timeframe. When we performed it in New York in January of this year, I mean, COVID was probably already active and like moving around New York City at that time. You know, I, you know, was moving around to San Francisco and Philadelphia a few weeks after that, and it was probably already like infiltrating our communities. So it's strange to see so much of the world change within that time period, within a year, and to also just be able to continue to perform that piece, like that is astounding, especially to perform a piece that is live in that way, and to have the opportunity to like come back to it and reflect on it. Like that's not something that I think a lot of artists have had the opportunity to really do right now. But it was also interesting to see how much of like the national sort of conversation around like race and settler colonialism changed within that time period too. I mean, that work is about destroying racist stereotypes and histories and lineages that are tied to white supremacy and this romanticization and glorification of westward expansion and indigenous genocide and exclusion of Black and brown communities, enslaved histories, and just fucked up colonial conquest. And so to start off the year doing that, and then to move through like the Black Lives Matter movement and all these racist statues like being pulled down and drowned and destroyed, it was just really beautiful and poetic in a way, that I feel like shattered within like an Indigenous performance sort of lens, like is a part of that history. And so when I think about like the work that Indigenous and Black and brown communities do on a continual basis, and that we have done for like centuries and decades, that we have been doing for the last, you know, I don't know, I feel like 10 years or so, you know, so much language and has changed within like Indigenous, Black, brown, trans, queer communities. I feel like a lot of that work is just naturally tied to ceremonial aspects of healing. And so I feel like it's no coincidence that all this shit came to a head this year in this way. It's no coincidence that all of this like destruction and healing and horrible shit has like reared itself in this year. But I also think that it's the aftermath of like so much of our resistance, so much of us creating this work and having these conversations and developing languages and challenging one another, writing poetry, creating memes, like making visual art, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, I feel like we're all talking about this year as like it's a, you know, huge shit show, and it has been, but there's also like this really bright flash of hope that's happened with, you know, seeing how people and are thinking differently, and at least on the surface level, trying to engage in a way that I haven't seen in, you know, the past however many years. So I'm trying to keep in mind that not everything that's happened this year has been bad, that there is actually some really great stuff that's going on as well.
Yeah, for real. Yeah. And I was just watching, I mean, whatever. News outlets are shit, and they're partially to blame. Like, it's amazing to see how many news outlets now are just like calling Republicans on their shit and like holding like a very firm ground all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's like, y'all are responsible for putting this shit bag into his position of power in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Y'all should have been cutting him off like 4 years ago. Anyway, It's also interesting to, like, I was watching CNN earlier and just watching, like, the overwhelming amount of, like, because I'm not going to tell people to vote. You know, I'm not going to tell them to take part in a really fucked up colonial, racist colonial system that is about the continued oppression of Indigenous Black and Brown communities, that is about the continued colonization of sacred Indigenous land. But at the same time, I'm not going to, like, criticize or hold back or refrain from also having joy in the fact that, like, so many Black, Indigenous, and Brown community people are experiencing, like, that joy right now and are responsible for defending the settler colonial nation state. You know, it's very interesting, but it's also interesting to see, like, some of the news correspondents talking about that joy, talking about communities of color who have been working very hard these last few years through social media to create community. That's been really nice that they're just now starting to, like, really affirm that. But it also really fucking sucks because that should have been happening from the get-go. Like, that space should have been honored and considered sacred, like, from the get-go.
Yeah. For the context of listeners, we're recording this on the day that we found out that Biden won the election and not Trump. So
a weird day.
Yeah.
it's been a really weird day.
I was outside earlier getting coffee and, like, walking around my neighborhood with a mask, of course, but all of a sudden there were fireworks and, like, people clapping outside. And I was like, oh, it's a weird feeling to be in the middle of a pandemic with a mask and, like, walking very, very far from people and the people just coming outside and celebrating and then knowing immediately what they're celebrating. And you're like, oh, okay, well, I guess this is good news.
Yeah, there were some kids, like, walking around the neighborhood, like, banging pots and pans, and people were, like, shouting out the window.
So funny.
By the way, I love your mask wall.
Oh yeah. Thank you. Second interview in a row it's come up. Yeah. It's my nice background. It's a reminder for everybody. Please. I'm curious about the 2017 TBA curatorial thing that you did to highlight Indigenous and Brown punk energy, which I thought was very interesting. And I wanted to dive into your history with punk and Riot Girl music. And why don't you take me through that?
Well, first of all, like most people, I think I came to understand and appreciate punk through a white lens. I was just actually watching this documentary on, is it Vivian Westwood?
That sounds familiar. Is that the
designer
the shop in the UK?
Yeah, yeah. And she's sort of, like, you know, is credited with creating, like, the whole punk aesthetic and punk vibe energy of that whole region. But yeah, anyway, I was watching that and I was just like, okay, like, I'm inspired by this and this is very interesting. And but at the same time, I think, you know, I didn't really realize, I think maybe I recognize punk as, like, a subculture, a music genre, and a fashion and style, you know, as I was growing up. But I didn't realize that, like, punk energy was already all around me. And so I think, you know, at some point I realized that punk energy and the ideology of punk and subversion and anarchism and resistance to conformity and nation state and what is considered, like, normal, or normative at least, all that exists within, like, Indigenous Black and Brown communities. like that energy. Like when I was thinking about punk growing up, I was thinking about Riot Girl. You know, I was thinking about like Patti Smith and Television and the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, and you know, I had it all wrong. Like, I mean, yeah, sure, they're punk. You know, they get to profit off of that. They get to live that, and they get to create culture around that. But at the same time, a lot of these spaces really ignore indigenous peoples. And so, you know, when I was growing up and I was exposed to Riot Girl, you know, through Slater Kinney and Kathleen Hanna, Bikini Kill, Bratmobile, a lot of that activism, you know, was about, or a lot of that activism that I was attracted to was about creating space and being and resisting heteropatriarchy. But you know, I feel like it was, I mean, even now as I sort of talk about it, I don't talk about it necessarily the same way. Like I don't buy into it as much. I think it's important that those scenes existed. I think Riot Girl was very influential and beneficial, not only to myself, but a shit ton of white women. It allowed them an entryway into co-opted intersectional politics from a white female lens, like Kathleen Hanna and a lot of those other punk women. But at the same time, I just don't, I'm just not as inspired by it anymore. I'm not as interested in it anymore. I can't listen to Slater Kinney the same way, knowing that Carrie Brownstein is a capitalist and is like partially responsible for like the continued gentrification of Portland. I just refuse to sort of give that community like as much energy as I feel like other communities deserve. And so with Death Dance, I was really interested in sort of like amplifying a lot of the energy that was actually coming out of like indigenous and brown communities and black communities as well. And so for that performance, you know, 2017, it was like after the election, after the inauguration, I was having a conversation with this indigenous artist who lives here, Sarah Seastrom, and we were talking about how white supremacy itself was kind of going through this like really gnarly sort of like death. And she referred to it as a death dance. Like when a fish comes out of water, when you take a salmon out of water and it sort of just flops around until it's dead. We were sort of like comparing that to the fact that at that time, like the rise of white supremacy and neo-Nazi communities that helped to get Trump elected in the first place, that all of that was a result of this really fucked up community sort of like realizing that they're in the last sort of like remaining positions of their power or influence, that this is sort of like their last stand. And so, you know, the term death dance was sort of like in honor of that, of realizing that and having those conversations with one another. And also holding space for other indigenous punk bands and indigenous musicians and activists and artists and writers who are doing these things within their communities. So, you know, we brought in Weed Rat from Albuquerque. They're a primarily indigenous punk band, Dene punk band, who are working out of Albuquerque. And then we brought in San Antonio's Riot Girl Chicanic punk band, Fia. And so they, you know, really took over the night. But we also had interspersed engagements with Blanca Villalobos. They had also performed for that evening. Sherita Town had done some live printing for us. We had like these bags that evening. And so it was just we were thinking about it as a two-spirit, queer, trans, indigenous, black, brown sort of prom night. That was the kind of the theme. And I think it also was like, no, it wasn't after the wildfires, but yeah, that was a really great moment. And I was hoping that, you know, we could have sort of like continued to sort of have future death dances, that, you know, that this sort of like energy and this sort of community would like continue to be supported. I mean, that the whole like punk and like noise and metal energy that was coming out at that time was really amazing. Is still really amazing. We had wanted to bring Downtown Boys from LA out, like that would have been really fucking rad. Or if Gloss was still around. I just feel like there's just so much energy and so much amazing community that exists within punk communities, especially like queer communities. And so that was a way that I was trying to honor that and hold space for that. Rebecca Jones from Weed Rat is just like a badass, you know, really an advocate for reproductive health and safe sex practices on the reservation. And so there's just a lot that I think that we can do as community members in order to honor one another and lift up one another and hold space for each other. But also to like get these institutions to like fucking pay us to do this work.
Yeah.
No, like that's what the other part of my practice is like finding out ways that like these institutions can get me to like program shit so I can like pay people to continue to do their work. Cause that's one way of having or of enacting reparations and taking over those institutional spaces.
Yeah, and that's part of what RISE does as well, right? It has different residencies and grant programs to help other Indigenous artists and poets. That's part of RISE, is that correct?
Well, RISE, we mostly do things through exhibition, programming, zines, and we have a fellowship program. Hmm. We would love to have a residency program. And I think that, you know, was a long-term goal, or it is still a goal. You know, we'll see how this whole pandemic sort of thing pans out.
Right.
That would be amazing to be able to bring artists together. I mean, even if, like for like our own like sort of festival, you know, I'm just about to publish this next year's round of funding for the RISE Fellowship, which is dedicated to Indigenous, queer, trans, two-spirit, gender non-conforming, non-binary artists and poets. And so, you know, I was hoping that after this year, we could potentially work on putting together some sort of like exhibition programming or festival to highlight the artists who had received funding so far. But a lot of the work that RISE does is about creating space and visibility for Indigenous communities, but also for challenging heteropatriarchal cisgender supremacy within not only our communities, but also within non-Indigenous communities. At the time that we sort of started this work, we just didn't feel like there were a lot of spaces that were doing it. And the fellowship program actually came out of like my own rejection from a potentially amazing fellowship opportunity where I had a conversation with the director. And after I had that conversation with the director, I realized that their supporting of Indigenous, queer, and two-spirit, trans, non-binary communities was not a necessity. I mean, I've done work with like equity programs and organizations who wanted to change, like equity and diversity programs that wanted to change the way their organizations functioned. And they made those decisions and they realized that those were things that they wanted to address. And these are things that, like, every institution, every organization will tell you is so difficult to change and alter, but they're really fucking easy to do. You just have to have a director who is dedicated to doing that and who wants to change it immediately. If you can give out fellowships for $25,000 a year to, like, numerous artists, you have the money and the wherewithal within your program to make these fucking changes. Like, there's no excuse at this point. It's 2020. And if you're going to be an Indigenous organization and claim that you are speaking for the people and traditional Indigenous, like, identities, then you also need to realize that Indigenous queer and trans and gender gradient community members are a natural part and of Indigenous communities, you know? And so after I got that sort of rejection and realized that this organization didn't have, like, my best interest at hand, I realized that these things aren't going to change unless we change them ourselves. So that RISE Fellowship program, the initial one, was just self-funded. And it was like, if you can give me fucking money to do the work that I'm going to do, I'm going to show you that, like, I'm going to take whatever resources I have as an Indigenous artist and share them with other artists as an example that, like, we got our backs and we're going to look out for one another and we're going to do this for ourselves, because we cannot wait for hetero cisgender communities and entities to save us, to empower us. Like, we got to do this work for ourselves. And so I think that's a lot of the work that RISE does, is about maintaining and holding that space that we got to do this for ourselves and we got to do this for one another. We're not perfect and we don't have all the answers, but, like, we're trying really fucking hard to hold that space. Sorry, I hope that gives some sort of, like, background.
No, totally. That's great.
You did a number of performances for An Infected Sunset, and I was wondering if that paved a lot of ways for you mentally, not in the world, which I'm sure it did too, but to then perform Shatter, meaning, like, that those readings and those events, especially the one like the Whitney Museum and things like that, had a lot of noise elements as well and different musical performances. Mm. And did you come off of the back of that kind of tour and that experience being like, oh, this is a good way to communicate my message and to perform the energy?
Yeah. I mean, I always wanted to make music. I just don't have the patience to learn an instrument. I even bought a guitar at the beginning of the pandemic and was so convinced I was going to teach myself to play it. I have not, but I also, like, see the value in collaboration. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted to collaborate with my cousin Kevin, and also honor their practice as an Indigenous performance artist and composer and such. So yeah, An Infected Sunset was amazing. I love to tour. The first poetry tour that I did was with this Chinese migrant artist, Jess X Chen, who does a lot of really amazing, like, visual work. Jess X Snow. They are really fucking amazing. We had done this tour together called Solastalgia, where we went from LA all the way to New York. And that was just so reaffirming to our practice as, like, queer artists of color. That was, it was just mind-blowing and eye-opening, just the amount of support that we had along the way, how many people came up, showed up, and were affected and empowered by it. And so I kind of wanted to continue doing that. And Infected Sunset was written in 2016. And I began that poem in August at the Columbia River Gorge at Russo Rock, which is a nude beach. It was, you know, after the Pulse nightclub shooting, the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, began to become really active. The No Dakota Access Pipeline, No DAPL resistance in Standing Rock was really active. And I wasn't able to show up for my communities who weren't in Portland at the time. And I was really like struck and bothered by that. You know, a lot of people that I knew were going to Standing Rock because they wanted to be a part of that movement. I never went, you know, I had work that I needed to do. I don't always feel comfortable in protest sort of settings. You know, I feel like my work can be doing other things. My friend Tracy Schlapp here in Portland, Oregon, she does like Cumbersome Multiples and the Folsom 50 Project. We were talking at the beginning of the protests that were happening here in Portland that, like, you know, she compared it so beautifully. She was like, you know, what was she? Oh my God, I can't even remember. She was talking about like how there are all sorts of like different responsibilities for people, like, you know, during these social movements, like, you know, even people need to like be in the background, like doing the dishes and like cleaning shit up. Like there's a lot of like undervalued labor that just doesn't get seen. And I feel like the best way that I can sort of work as like a visual artist, as a poet, is to do some of that work, is to create memes, to create poetry, to create books and such. So an Infected Sunset was sort of my way to give back to the community through poetry and through performance art. And that piece, you know, whenever I've read it, for the most part, has been read from beginning to end. So it's a very long, you know, process. For the iteration that we had done at TBA, I had brought in Holland Andrews, who is an amazing performance artist. And we had collaborated together on that piece for An Infected Sunset, where, you know, for the first half of it, I read on my own, and then they come in and begin to perform, and then I leave the stage and they finish everything up. That was an amazing opportunity to sort of blend and mix and collaborate with another artist. And that completely changed that poem, like completely. It brought out like things. I mean, I had written that poem for like a year and a half or whatever. It was intense, like to write it at the beginning of the Standing Rock occupation and resistance, and then to continue to write it through the election of Donald Trump and the presidency, then that whole fucking shit show year afterward. It was intense. And so, but it was amazing to bring in this other sound element and energy of Holland, and just really sort of like detox to a certain degree. Like just it is some of the most amazing performance that I have done is collaborative work with sound artists. They're just able to reach into different parts of healing that like need to be brought out. And so, yeah, I feel like that work itself really helped me, really just led the way into working with like building the framework for what Shatter would become. At that time though, too, I was also working on other visual exhibitions and such. And a lot of that practice is about going into thrift stores and kind of just getting this idea of like what a community archive looks like in a different sense, you know, not just like, you know, looking at maps and documents and such, but actually looking at objects that people like have collected and preserved. in their homes and such. That also really helped lead the way into building the sort of framework that Shatter would become.
Yeah, as part of your artist talk for Shatter, you also said that objects aren't innocent. They have their history before they ended up at the thrift store. And that's it struck me as something I've never thought about, which is like an idiotic thing to say. But it's one of those things where it's like, oh, shit. Yeah, you're definitely right. And like all these like terrible things that have had to happen in order for that, you know, Pocahontas VHS tape to end up at the Goodwill is one of those things that has a weird epiphany ripple effect. Where it's like, oh, history bad. Oh, very bad. Oh, shit. And, you know, I thought that put a good context onto everything else that was happening also during Shatter, you know, the very harsh noise elements and the poetry and the atmosphere of, you know, not many people in this room, but this very loud thing in my headphones and my computer during a pandemic, and, you know, it was pretty intense. I really enjoyed it and it made me feel weird. And that's what I like in my performance art. So thank you for that.
It made a lot of people feel weird, but that's ultimately what we're after. We're not about like making people feel comfortable with it.
Yeah.
But we're also, I mean, that piece in particular, like also challenges people's like comfortability with like Indigenous anger.
Right.
And their criticism of it. Like that piece makes people really uncomfortable because they're not wanting to see the ways that Indigenous communities like are angry and are pissed off about this, about the history and atrocities that we've endured. But also like that's as, you know, we're not out there in the streets with like guns trying to hold down our space or anything. Like this is our way of healing. Y'all can participate in it for like 20 minutes. Like we have to deal with that shit our entire lives.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think it's a good space to hold and to, you know, especially during something like TBA, which I think has a pretty wide audience that is open to experiencing some weirdness. But even in that space, that was probably the more intense slated performance on that roster, I thought, which I really loved. Yeah.
I'm curious, you mentioned that Shatter as a piece, you didn't want it documented beyond like kind of people talking or writing about it. Have you read much about the piece after performing it, or do you kind of stay away from what people write about your work?
Well, that's the other thing, is like we want people to write about it, but there's very few people who have written about it. Mm. There was a couple pieces that came out of the performance-based performance. Stephanie Snyder said that you know, they were sort of like reflecting and writing about it. And then Ashley Stuhlmeyers recently just, who was one of the curators for the Portland Biennial last year, they just recently wrote an essay for the Hallie Ford Fellowship exhibition that is currently up at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art in Eugene, Oregon. They wrote an essay that included, you know, a write-up on Shatter. But yeah, not enough people have written about it. I would love to write about it. I mean, I was really interested in writing as like a form of documentation, because a lot of like the earlier performances from like the Dada movement, or a lot of the writing from like the 60s and 70s was only documented through writing. And so I became really fascinated in sort of that imagination, like the imagining of what this sort of scene looked like. I remember reading this piece actually. It was probably a performance in the 80s or 90s. It was a piece that James Luna had done. I don't know if there's any visual documentation of it. I haven't delved that far into it. But it's a performance that he had done in Santa Fe, where he was performing like what it is to be Indian. I think he came out like as this like playful character, you know, sort of like engaging with people, being funny. And then he left the stage and came back out and was acting like a drunk Indian, or, you know, what people consider drunk Indian, like asking people for money. And I remember just reading about this, and the person who wrote about it was talking about how uncomfortable it made people. Like, people were willing to like laugh at him before and engage with him before. And then when he came out as this like uncomfortable stereotype, people wouldn't even look him in the face. Mm-hmm. Like, they wouldn't even watch him perform. They were so uncomfortable by it. And I like that resonated with me so much. Like and when I read that, I realized like how impactful performance art could be. How just amazing that sort of like shift was, like how you're able to just completely turn the audience's like vision and perception and reflection back onto themselves, like almost in an instant. And sometimes in a way that they're not even really aware of, that just like sticks with them. And I feel like Shatter does that. Like it forces you, a non-Indigenous, primarily like white viewer, to really like reflect on your own sort of involvement in the settler colonial project, your own complacency and your own unknowing, and how that unknowing has like contributed to that complacency. And so that's one thing that I think is really successful in that piece. And I feel like sometimes that can only come through really watching the performance, really thinking about it, reflecting on it, like through the act of writing and talking to people about it. It's not necessarily something that can come that comes so easily through just documenting it or creating like a post about it on social media. Like, there are some things that I feel like deserve a sacred space of reflection. And I don't know if that's necessarily up for like myself or Kevin to decide, mm-hmm. as the people who are creating these things. But it is something that I think that we're interested in sort of like fucking with, and seeing what happens. Cause I'm also, Rise came out of sort of like the same idea. Like, Rise initially was not supposed to, like, it was supposed to be an anonymous project. You know, I was really tired of like not seeing a lot of like Indigenous political artwork on the internet. And so I wanted to create all this work that was just very political and just have Rise Radical Indigenous Survivance and Empowerment attached to it, but not have any sort of like idea of like who was creating the work, and just create all this work over like a five-year period and then stop it and then see how that, I wanted to see how that work was archived or referenced or looked at, you know, within like, you know, 10 years, 15, 20 years later. Because I'm really interested in this idea of like anonymity or just challenging, but also how we participate within like a settler colonial sort of like simulation of reality. And I feel like that's what has been happening and going on, is especially with technology. I feel like we've like entered into this idea of like simulation as a way to sort of like forget the fact that like settler colonialism is like this disgusting and terrible thing that needs to stop. And so I feel like, you know, there are these moments of disruption that we're able to sort of break our complacency within that simulation. And I think, you know, asking people to witness something, to write about it, to think about it, to share it with other people is like that moment of disruption.
You were just listening to a broadcast of the Talking to Ghosts podcast that featured queer, Indigenous, transdisciplinary artist Dimion Dinet-Yage. To listen to the full episode, you can search for Talking to Ghosts wherever you find your podcast. That's it for Queercore tonight. We'll see you in the new year, Montreal. Stay queer as fuck. Good night. We're waiting.
took a look at his license plate. It said, just ice. It's justice, just ice. Governed by greed and lust. Just the strong doing what they can. And the weak suffering what they must. Oh, and the caskets. And the oil spills. And sex sells everything.
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Still looking for a holiday gift or two for the special people in your life? CKUT has new merch, including hoodies and t-shirts, that showcase classic designs dug up from our art attic. Head to ckut.ca to discover our new merch store and find out more about sizing and shipping. Happy holidays from all of us at CKUT.
These folks at CKUT love their 100% certified organic and fair trade gourmet coffee from Saint-Tropez. Prepared in the heart of Montreal with beans from all over the world, you can find and get your own cup of freshly brewed Saint-Tropez coffee from AUS Snacks on McGill Campus or from Café Saint-Tropez on the corner of Saint-Urbain and Duluth.
I need a fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh, fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh, fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Hey, hey, miss.
Si vous avez présenté une demande d'indemnisation pour des sévices subis dans un pensionnat indien, sachez que les dossiers de votre demande sont protégés. Ils seront détruits en septembre 2027, à moins que vous ne choisissiez de les conserver ou de les partager. Pour en savoir davantage, composez le numéro sans frais 1-877-635-2648.